The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, South Jersey and Philadelphia. Welcome to Inside Medicine. I'm happy to say that you're going to be lucky to have me the whole day on this Easter weekend. And I do want to start out with a little bit about diabetes and cerebral vascular disease. So diabetes hits many of us, and the problem is that when someone has diabetes, there's at least in 20 to 40% of patients, there is a significant risk of stroke. Stroke is devastating, and that's one of the things that motivates me to make sure that some risk factors are well controlled. So patients with diabetes have a 2 to 6 times greater risk of cerebrovascular complications, i.e. stroke. Comorbidities, in other words, items that can push someone in that direction, include obesity, hypertension, dyslipidemia, which often coexist with diabetes. Cerebrovascular risk factors certainly can be influenced. How does one adjust what's going on in the body? Can you get better blood pressure control? Can you make sure that those blood vessels and those toes aren't squeezed down, have atherosclerotic plaque, and don't provide the blood flow to those toes you want? How about things like taking an aspirin a day, enteric style, to make sure that platelets don't clot? You can talk to this with your cardiologist or family doctor. And what about inhibiting clotting systems? That is sometimes up for the specialist, but again, it can improve. Treatment of blood pressure to a value less than 130 over 80 is recommended in patients with type 2 diabetes to reduce the risk of stroke. Low-density lipoprotein over 100 is verboten, and basically 20% of diabetic patients have that. So LDL, or low-density lipoprotein, is the bad cholesterol when you talk to your doctor. It's very important. The usual lipid profiles have 5 things, a total cholesterol, a bad cholesterol, a good cholesterol, 2 other items. And the goal is to focus on the LDL, low-density lipoprotein, which is the most nasty lipid particle. That particle is elevated in over 20% of diabetics who are type 2. Now, how do we make sure that people don't get strokes? One item is attacking hypertension. Hypertension is very common, and the answer is treating hypertension results in less pressure on blood vessels, especially when the blood vessels have a curve in the blood profile. Curves generate more pressure and more atherosclerosis at curves. Most patients with diabetes and hypertension should be treated with a blood pressure less than 130 over 80. Usually we're taught if your blood pressure is over 135, 85, that you deserve a blood pressure pill. Studies report that low blood pressure for individuals with type 2 reduces the risk of stroke, retinopathy, and albuminuria substantially. One large meta-analysis with only 79,000 people with diabetes demonstrated that tighter blood pressure control may reduce stroke by 31%. Like I tell my patients, I don't really care if I get a heart attack. I just don't want that stroke. Laying in a bed with one arm, one leg, half a brain, just doesn't seem what I want to do. So long-term intensive glycemic control, how good you get your blood sugars, is also important to improve cardiovascular outcomes in type 2 diabetics. Systolic blood pressure, the top number the doctor gives you, may be a stronger risk factor for cerebral vascular disease in type 2 diabetics than possibly even glycemic control. Just to tell you this, the average person takes 3 blood pressure pills. So when the doctor says you need 2, you need 3, don't sweat it. If you need 4, maybe you can discuss that a little bit in more depth. The American Diabetes Association also recommends statins for type 2 diabetics anybody in the ages of 40 to 75. I think sometimes that when I recommend this and I see patients' eyes, they just hate the idea that maybe they're getting older, or maybe they're not as healthy as they should be when a doctor recommends certain therapies. But statin therapies are incredibly effective. They reduce MI, stroke, and death by 45% if you can get your bad cholesterol down to 74. So say the great blood pressure is 135 over 85 or under that, and then you can get a statin. You're going to improve your statin therapy to get your LDL less than 72, 74. You're going to have a substantially better chance of living a long time with all the tissues that you were born with. What about exercise? So COVID's kind of gone. Yes, we're pushing these vaccines in the medical field, but really, the people walking in the neighborhood now has decreased substantially. Things have fallen off a little bit. Before, the only place you could go is walk around your neighborhood, and how many people did you meet? But 30 minutes or more of moderate intensity daily physical activity is recommended for primary prevention of stroke in diabetic patients. Stroke, as far as I'm concerned, is nasty. So patients with type 2 diabetes should have a blood pressure, according to the guidelines, less than 130 over 80. If someone is older and has stiffened vessels, a lot of times the doctor will discuss that, and a higher blood pressure can be okayed. Usually first-line therapy for that consists of ACE inhibitors or angiotensin-converting blockers or calcium channel blockers or diuretics. They're the four starting points, and they reduce risk by 27%. Coronary artery disease, get your heart attack later, 29%. Heart failure, nasty, 25%. And all-cause mortality down about 18% in diabetics. So blood pressure is a really fantastic save, and basically the medications we have today are excellent. But remember that the average person takes three blood pressure pills. I see patients' eyes just melt down when I ask them to get a second pill or a third pill. But this is the usual needed dose, three blood pressure pills. That way we can use lower doses of each individual agent, which can synergize when two or three are utilized. So again, if the physician suggests you take two or three, just remember they're doing their job and basically going to get you better results. So the bottom line is that there's something called albuminuria. So this is a big deal now because we have medications that have just ramped up intervention for when patients lose albumin. So albumin is a large protein that circulates in the blood for nutrition, but also if you have renal insufficiency, that can leak out of your kidney. When albumin leaks out, there's a special test we can do. It's a spot urine. We can get it any time. You don't have to do anything special. Pee in that cup at the lab and it comes back in a few days, and it'll tell you how much albumin you are leaking. If you're less than 30, you're a star. And I can tell you this, that it's twice a week I see patients who have a albumin leak come back after the medication we put them on, and there's no more albumin leak anymore. They're actually just can't believe that I tell them something that's serious got better so quick. But patients who get ACE inhibitors, ARBs, or other type of medications such as Kerendia can reverse that albumin leak 100%. Now, if you're less than 30, you're a star. If you're 30 to 100, we got to watch you a little bit and get some kind of medication on. If you're over 300, most of the doctors will refer you to a specialist, such as a nephrologist, a kidney doctor, to make sure that you get everything A to Z to make sure that they reverse that albuminuria. I can tell you this, and in clinical practice, the medications that we're using that reverse albuminuria or protein leak, which indicates kidney damage, are phenomenal. So good things occurring, and that's why there's four of these type of medications on the market, the SGLT2s. They work great. Jardiance, Farxiga, and Invokana. So we got some good stuff, and we can turn things around. So good news there. So the answer is 52% of people get SGLT2 inhibitors, like we were talking about, Farxiga and Jardiance, So that's the usual starting point. If you end up with a nephrologist, they're much more likely to include another type of medication, a certain blocker that can help out immensely too, and that's called Kerendia. So, just moving on. Numerous studies suggest that GLP-1 receptor agonists may reduce the risk of stroke in patients with type 2 diabetes mellitus. Now, everybody knows that these GLP agents are expensive. They're hard to get. Insurance guys don't like to give you the okay. They have certain criteria that they use. A lot of people are just doing it to look better because they generally lose significant weight in excess of 15% if used properly. But they also decrease stroke. They also basically help kidney function. So if you can get a GLP-1 drug that can cause a 39% reduction in non-fatal stroke and a 26% reduction in non-fatal myocardial infarct, heart attacks, that's kind of a deal as far as I'm concerned. Additionally, these drugs have shown that if you have any heart issues with any fluid retention, patients just are amazed that when they take these medications, all of a sudden their volume of fluid drops off substantially. They don't see it in their legs. They feel incredibly better. So these drugs can do a remarkable job, the SGLT2s, the GLP-1s, in making sure that strokes aren't there, making sure that fluid's not there, making sure your quality of life is there, making sure that you lose your weight. So combination therapies are in, and it's fantastic. So there is one issue to point out. High-dose insulin, notice I said high-dose insulin. So if everybody makes less than 50 units a day and you've got a 200 ring, that's high-dose insulin. And sulfonylurea drugs, we don't use them that often, even on the market 30 years. They're incredibly efficacious. I will tell you this, that the space program gives astronauts sulfonylurea in space because basically they want to make sure that in space you tend to become more diabetic. So they can't be that bad, but again, they're very inexpensive. They've been around a long time, and they're very efficacious. Nothing like taking a sulfonylurea, and you don't have to get up at night to go flush the toilet. So there's a number of issues that we'd like to say just are making things better. Just remember GLP-1s and just remember SGLT-2 drugs. You can ask your doctor about that. Just fantastic. Now, you have to remember that the SGLT-2 drugs are only for type 2 diabetics and for those who are obese. They are not for type 1s. Generally, when you have a GLP-1 drug, you need to take less and less insulin, and when you get under that certain level, you can go into diabetic ketoacidosis. So Europe is a little bit more different than us, but right now Europe, I think, has an okay with certain GLP-1s that have a little bit of a different pharmacology, but not in the U.S. So type 1, if you ask your doctor and you're a type 1 to give you GLP-1, he or she's got to say no. It's just not approved for that. Now, so let me move on a little bit to cancer. Cancer certainly is not one of my favorite things to talk about, but I just wanted to talk about some of the issues that occur with colorectal cancer. So it's very, very hard to get people sometimes to go get one of those studies. But basically, when you're 40, 45, it's time to get a check of that stool. The bottom line is there's different tests called Cologuard, which can predict that if they see a certain entity in your stool, that would indicate a cancer. But colorectal does not take away, the Cologuard does not take away polyps. So generally, the worry is that if you have a polyp, will that polyp turn into a cancer? So the Cologuard does not take away that polyp. So generally, I recommend for my patients is they get a colonoscopy. It's over quick. There's incredible capabilities in the community by GI specialists. And if you get that colonoscopy and you lose your three polyps, that's three chances of cancer you had. So again, Cologuard is great. If you're timid, you don't want to put that rear end up in the air, but they don't take away any polyps. So that's Cologuard, which can certainly help out if you're timid, but the gastroenterologist will take off polyps if you have any, which are a potential predetermined cancer risk. So the bottom line, bloody stool, progressive constipation, time for you to think about getting that GI consult. Again, bloody stool, progressive constipation, time to get some help. Now, the American Cancer Society reports that colorectal cancer is the third leading cause of cancer-related deaths in men and women in the United States, one that's expected to cause 50,630 deaths, and that's in 2018. I guess I got to get more update, but that's a lot of deaths. So again, if you have colorectal cancer, you're going to see a colorectal surgeon. They're highly trained, do a great job. Yes, they take care of the colon. Yes, they take care of the rectum. Yes, they can take care of anal cancer. But the bottom line is that we've got excellent doctors in this area, the Philadelphia, New Jersey marketplace, that can help out. Now, please note that GI doctors also take care of inflammatory bowel disease, such as Crohn's and ulcerative colitis, diverticulitis, that's where there's an irritation in the gut, anal rectal problems such as hemorrhoids, fissures and anal fissures. So they do a lot, including tree constipation and fecal incontinence. So seeing the GI guy is not my favorite, but it's a necessary, should I say evil or good? I'll say good, to make sure that that constipation's gone, make sure that chronic diarrhea, maybe because you've lost enough pancreatic enzymes for digestion, just so that rear end can be addressed for hemorrhoids and you can feel better. So GI guys, despite being rectal surgeons, are A-OK, and there's a ton of gals too. So again, colorectal surgeon, good people. Of course, everybody gets a chance to gastroenteritis, either from viruses or food. We're not talking about that. We're talking about persistent symptoms. Now, want to move on a second here. Now, there was a fantastic physician statement this week that I wanted to bring out, and this was in Barron's this week. Dr. William A. Wolkstein, he's from Livingston, New Jersey, letter to the editor. Preparing for my 61st birthday and Medicare eligibility, I attended a seminar, senior seminar, conducted by the hospital system where I was a practicing surgeon. Quote the title, Medicare Advantage is Under Fire, What It Means for Your Health and Wallet, was a cover story on March 20th. Hearing the choices available for seniors between traditional Medicare / Medigap versus the constraints imposed by Advantage programs, it became readily apparent just how good traditional Medicare is. The most advantageous way to use the traditional system is to seek care at an academic institution where the traditional Medicare system is almost universally accepted and the standard of care is at a high level of performance. This was a statement in Barron's today by Dr. William A. Wolkstein in Livingston, New Jersey. I think he hit the nail on the head. Remember, those Medicare advantages are loaded with pre-certs. Do you get what you want? Do you get what you need? That's an issue. So I happen to think that Surgeon Wolkstein, who is now 65 apparently, definitely knew what he was talking about. Let's move on to researchers near safer anti-clotting drugs. So blood thinners are being developed that carry a lower risk of bleeding. I am not advised to utilize anticoagulants in my patients. They want that to go to more or less doctors that do that all the time, and I concur. But it's very important to make sure that some people need anticoagulation or make their blood clot less quickly to prevent heart attacks and strokes. So these drugs are around. Now, what's come out fantastic is that there is a few GI drugs coming along that will treat atrial fibrillation patients who aren't taking anticoagulation at this time. Studies show an estimated 40 to 60% of atrial fib patients refuse to take, stop taking, or skip doses of anticoagulants, or their doctors decide not to prescribe them. That leads to more than 50,000 preventable strokes each year in the U.S. alone. So the issue is that the problem is when you give somebody an anticoagulant, I remember warfarin when I started. Now they have factor 9 drugs that help out. So things have gotten better, but still always an issue. So Xarelto is in the works, good drug, but again, people are trying to stay away from those good drugs because they just don't like the fact that they can bleed. So Eliquis is the number one seller, does a great job, very safe, but what they're looking at, and which has made the Wall Street Journal today, is that there is a new drug, a Sundexin, which was stopped in treatment because it was so efficacious in preventing stroke and atrial fibrillation, and it was tested against Eliquis. So again, coming around the corner is better anticoagulation medication that can prevent stroke and MI, especially if you have atrial fibrillation. Now, do want to talk about time and range. So it's very interesting in terms of the diabetic marketplace that generally we always thought about what's your A1C, and that gives you an estimate of what your blood sugar has been over the past 3 months. Red blood cells live about 3 months, and that's why that study comes out. And that was done by the University of Chicago. And the lead author of that later became the head of medicine at the University of Penn. He has since retired. So diabetic intervention has been moving along aggressively forward, and I'm happy to say very important stuff. So again, we used to go by the A1C test, which was done by people going into a hospital. They were paid in the University of Chicago, and they stuck them, I think, 8 times a day for 3 months. They got paid. And then what they did is they collected the data and were able to mathematically figure out if you have this coating on your red blood cell, that will correlate with 3 months of average sugars, and that's called the hemoglobin A1C. Test is easy to draw, gives incredible benefit, but coming around the corner now is time and range. So you can see how many people are just shocked to see what their sugar is every minute of the day if they want to take a look on these new sensors, which are fantastic. So again, time and range, like if you have an insulin pump, it'll tell you that you were in range 70% of the time. Well, if your diabetic range is appropriate 70% of the time, you are a very good diabetic. If you're less than that, it's time to jump on the bandwagon and check that sugar a little bit more, respond to that sugar a little bit more that's elevated. And, you know, work with your doctor to try and decide, is it time to give up on the pills? Is it time to go to 2 or 3 pills a day? Is it time to get on insulin? Is it time to do just basal insulin at night? Is it time to do 3 shots a day before meals and basal insulin? A lot to discuss, but the answer is that when you can see the data, all of a sudden people change what they eat. They see that particular item generated a high sugar. They get rid of it. So again, these sensors are changing the world. We anticipate that in 5 years, no one will be finger-pricking again. We do know that Medicare now, if you have a sensor, won't even pay for a strip for testing. Some people say that's nasty. Some people say it's okay, and I'm on the sideline. So one of the things we can do is look for this time and range. So time and range, like how often you are less than, say, 180, you can set your own guidelines. But every 5% increase in time and range correlates with a 16% decrease in retinopathy. So again, we always knew the A1Cs, and now you have a medication, an indication that if you can get your time and range, and the tighter the better, say 70 to 140, that your risk goes down for retinopathy 26%, and every 5% increase in time and range. So again, how good is your diabetes? And it's very hard to check every minute of the day, but these time and range are great. We do want to point out that in pregnancy, time and range is incredibly important. We have to make sure that the gals are essentially normal. We want to make sure that they are not starving to get to normal, because starvation ketones, if they do develop because one is not eating enough carbs, the baby will not like mom. So again, time and range is important. But if you're pregnant, you have to balance that out with tight control but appropriate eating, because we don't want anybody to develop ketones. Once your body senses that you don't have enough insulin, it starts to break down body fat to give you the energy to keep on going. But babies do not like ketones. Ketones are nasty for babies, and we just can't go that way. So again, we have now the A1C. We have time and range. We expect in 5 years no one will be pricking a finger anymore, but they'll be using sensor devices. Now, next item on the agenda. So the question is atrial fibrillation and heart failure. So atrial fibrillation means that the top of your heart is beating faster than the bottom, and normally there's a great correlation. The top of the heart, the two atrium, push blood into the ventricles, the right and left, in synchrony, so that there's a highly efficacious pump. When the heart pumps, things go incredibly well. The problem is that when someone has heart failure, it tends to provoke them going into atrial fibrillation, because basically when they have heart failure, there's an inability to push blood out both to the right and left side of the heart, and this generates an enlargement of the atrium size, and there's these electrical circuits that are running from the top of the heart down to the bottom. And when that happens, you can go into atrial fibrillation. So once you stretch that atrium, the circuits are affected, and the patient then can go into what they call atrial fibrillation or excessive heart rate. So again, if you have heart failure, that means your pump is decreased a bit. Better to go see the cardiologist and get pump perking medications than it is to hang around, wait till your top of your heart gets swollen. When that happens, the circuits are interrupted electronically, and the top part of the heart can start pumping faster than the bottom. Sometimes people are 150, 200 beats a minute. Obviously, those people belong in an ER quickly to get better. But again, when you have atrial fibrillation, it predisposes to heart. When you have heart failure, it predisposes to atrial fibrillation, and probably 50% of people on heart failure will develop AFib. So atrial fibrillation and heart failure are two commonly encountered conditions in cardiology practice. Owing to mutual risk factors, the two frequently occur together. Registry studies demonstrate that more than one half of patients with heart failure also have a diagnosis of atrial fib, i.e. the top part of the heart's going way faster than the bottom, which throws things out of kilter and the efficiency of the heart goes down. Among patients with heart failure, a secondary diagnosis is associated with greater symptom burden and more frequent hospitalization. So you have a combination of AFib and heart failure, things are worse. Now, the pathophysiology of heart failure is characterized by an elevated filling pressure, which means that the heart ventricle part doesn't have significant power to empty out that ventricle to go to the tissues, the brain, the toes. Activation of the renin-angiotensin system occurs, and that's why doctors, cardiac specialists, will start to introduce medications that can improve the heart efficiency, and in doing so, take the pressure off the heart. So again, filling pressure means that the heart, the ventricle, doesn't have the power to kick out sufficient amount of blood that it has been placed by the atrium on the top. So heart failure patients are usually treated with ACE inhibitors and certain renin type of medications that have been modified. So again, heart failure has a reduced ejection fraction. What that means, the percentage of blood that the heart kicks out on each pump is reduced. The development of atrial fibrillation in patients with heart failure is common and is associated with worse outcome. Certain guidelines have been established by the AMA and cardiology centers of excellence, giving evidence of the benefit of strong control of patients with heart failure can avoid AFib and help people out. So again, atrial fibrillation, not a favorite product, and we want to make sure that that doesn't go into if people with heart failure don't go into atrial fibrillation, seeing your doc makes sense. Now, I want to talk about a vitamin D. So vitamin D has been in the news. Vitamin D seems to be a wintertime thing in Jersey, because basically when you get down past the summertime, vitamin D, based on the, because it requires a certain angle for the sunlight to hit that will make vitamin D in human skin. And additionally, when it gets colder, most of us aren't hanging out with our bathing suits. So vitamin calcium levels tend to drop because vitamin D is responsible for bringing in adequate calcium levels. Now, there has been a recent hubbub that the simultaneous use of calcium, elemental calcium, and vitamin D does have some negativity. And there's been a general recommendation, not officially established right now, that it's better just to use vitamin D. Now, vitamin D deficiency does predispose in diabetics a progression to peripheral neuropathy. So in other words, their feet hurt, their feet burn, they can't feel their feet. So again, the goal right now is to more or less ask our patients to use vitamin D supplements and skip the calcium. The calcium also has a significant negative, because if you have calcium deficiency, that means you're going to lose bone. And what happens to gals when they lose bone? You know, are they going to get a Dowager's hump where you bend over? Of course, that takes time. But the average American's calcium level is a 9.6. So I think if you're a female and you are having any kind of bone issues, such as loss of bone, such as a serum calcium level that's way below the average 9.6, you want to talk that over with your doctor to try and get a supplement. Like I say, right now, calcium supplements out, because that actually gives GERD, because to get those calcium substances to be melted down, lots of stomach acid comes out, gives you your GERD. So right now, and there's this issue of potential cancer, so right now the deal is just give the vitamin D. Remember, there's two Ds, there's a D2 and a D3. The D3 is recommended. The D2 hasn't shown to be that efficacious. It's on the market, over the counter, mainly because it doesn't have, it's been there a long time, but it's not as good as the vitamin D3. So D3 is in, 2,500, 5,000 a day. You can talk to your doctor. There are certain patients who have what they call a 1-hydroxylase deficiency, which means they can't upgrade their vitamin D. Those people tend to show up in a car accident with multiple fractures, and they need aggressive intervention. So again, vitamin D is in, calcium and vitamin D at the same time is out. And again, if you can't get that with aggressive vitamin D therapy, the standard over-the-counter stuff, D3, that means you probably have an abnormality called a 1-hydroxylase block, and you need to be put on vitamin D calcitriol, which is a prescription-only product. I actually recently saw somebody who had bone issues, had a very low vitamin D, and had a very high PTH, parathyroid hormone. So what happens is, if you're vitamin D deficient, the body then revs up parathyroid hormone. There's four glands in your neck, and they all of a sudden start to pummel the bones with parathyroid hormone and suck out the calcium out of your bone, which isn't good if you're osteoporotic or if you're deciding to get hit by on a football field or in a car accident. So I saw tons of car accidents with people who had 1-hydroxylase blocks because they'd be in a minor accident and break a ton of bones. So again, lots of vitamin D will not fix somebody who has that 1-hydroxylase block. You need to use the prescription medication. If you give them the prescription medication, their vitamin D will go up. The vitamin D will increase the calcium. The calcium will then go to the bone, and the patient will be good as new, but will need calcitriol on a daily basis for the rest of their life, because they don't want to turn into a Dowager's hump type patient. So diabetic research and clinical practice explored the link between vitamin D deficiency and diabetic peripheral neuropathy in patients 60 years and older with type 2 diabetes. The article concluded that vitamin D deficiency is independently associated with higher risk of diabetic peripheral neuropathy. The article concluded that vitamin D deficiency is independently associated with higher risk of diabetic The research also found that vitamin D may promote the development, which impact nerve fibers and decrease various neuropathies. So vitamin D is in. Shoot for your calcium to get a mean of 9.6. If it won't go up despite aggressive vitamin D, talk to your doctor about, quote, a 1-hydroxylase block. I'm sure he'll be glad to hear you say that, but his eyes will open and his chin will go up and say, yes, ma'am. Peripheral neuropathy occurs when damage has been done to peripheral nervous system, resulting in loss of signals, inappropriate signaling, and distorted signaling. So that's what they're talking about, that the vitamin D is not right, peripheral neuropathy can intervene. The American Diabetes Association says that about 50% of patients with diabetes have some type of nerve damage. It's more common in patients who've had diabetes for many years. Symptoms include numbness, tingling, and affect over 1 billion people worldwide. It's the most common complication of type 2 diabetes patients, which can affect sleep quality, mental health, ability to work. It can lead to ulcers, fractures, and even amputations. Vitamin D is a complex vitamin that works in multiple body areas. Some even classify this vitamin as a hormone. An individual from the Case Western Reserve University of Medicine, Dr. Hatipoglu, says that the vitamin influences the mood, immune system, and cardiovascular system, and that research has shown that it has a relationship to cancer, metabolic disease, heart disease, and autoimmune disease. You better make sure your calcium is 9.6, hearing all that. So I'm going to kind of move on. Just remember, vitamin D is in. Make sure that if you can't get your vitamin D, your calcium level up with vitamin D over the counter, time to talk to the doctor, time to make sure that you're not one of those who has a 1-hydroxylase block, and you need to get the prescription-only medication for your overall well-being. Now, let's talk a little bit about hyperlipidemia. So hyperlipidemia, we already talked a little bit about Dr. Fallon and trying to convince people to take a statin drug at time, because a lot of people just don't like to take their first medication. The Cleveland Clinic years ago did a phenomenal 2 studies, Jupiter and Prove It, that basically revolutionized cardiovascular intervention in the United States. There are 2 studies demonstrated that if your LDL cholesterol, your bad cholesterol, is 74, you get a 45% reduction in MI, stroke, and death. Now, that's what I call a good bang for your dollar. LDL 74, bad cholesterol, and you get a 45% reduction in MI, stroke, and death. Now, I'm the guy who just does not want a stroke. It was just a little too tough for me. I had to visit my Uncle Ed, who had a stroke. Taught me how to hit a curveball, and he was in bed in a nursing home with a significant stroke and just a devastating event. So cardiovascular disease is the leading cause of mortality in America, claiming about 65,000 lives annually. What about the ones that are partially damaged? Ouch. Cardiovascular disease has been linked to many modifiable risk factors in the literature, particularly blood pressure. Get blood pressure, and that we're in trouble. Low-density lipoprotein, high-density lipoprotein, glucose intolerance, and smoking. So high total cholesterol involving the LDL, HDL, and triglycerides is considered to be greater than equal to 240. So what basically we're saying is that if you can get your bad cholesterol down, your cardiovascular events are going to go way down. So you don't have to understand all the 5 different lipid profiles. We also have advanced lipid testing now that can tell us more, give a better insight. And one of the things that we're seeing in clinical practice is a calcium score. So a calcium score doesn't require blood. It usually requires $125. Insurance companies don't pay for calcium scores. But if you're concerned about, are you going to have a heart attack or stroke from a cardiovascular issue, the calcium score basically can help you make a decision whether or not you want to be a hard rear-end person and not get any statin, or if you want to get treated. But the calcium score indicates that there's been inflammation in your coronary arteries. It takes about 5 minutes to do. The radiology practices will shoot a CAT scan through your heart and determine how much calcium is in your blood vessels. You should have zero. If you got a zero, you spend $115. by mistake. If you have a positive, it's going to change your life because basically the cardiologist will rapidly put you on a medication to reduce your LDL cholesterol, usually to the 74 range. So again, a calcium score, no insurance coverage, $125, local radiology place, CAT scan, takes 5 minutes, and then gives you a diagnosis. So that basically is indicating that there is risk and that you want to get treated. And I can tell you this, that the calcium score definitely makes a lot of people change their mind because once they see it, they know that there's something they have to do, and we have things that can fix it. Generally, we start with the statin drugs. So the statins have been around for a while. There's been two major studies, Prove It and Jupiter, that indicated you get a significant 45% reduction in MI, stroke, and death if you're on these medications and your LDL is down to 74. I can tell you this, that pre-COVID, cardiovascular disease was just improving, less and less deaths. COVID kind of messed everything up because COVID almost overcame cardiovascular deaths in the United States. Just fell short. But COVID's better. At least it's not as toxic. I'm not in that business, but that's my sense. But again, making sure that you've got a fantastic LDL cholesterol is important. So let's just go over the physiology. So you have a gene that's giving you elevated bad cholesterol called the LDL. So what happens is that the LDL cholesterol gets into your vessel walls, and when the vessel walls are affected, it starts to cause a dysfunctional vascular endothelium. So the arteries have three layers. So there's the inner, the middle, and the exterior. The middle is the most important. And if all of a sudden you're developing supplements of cholesterol in the wall, it starts to dysfunction. So then macrophages come in. They're supposed to gobble up anything there that shouldn't be there. And so macrophages come into your vessel walls and then try to capture the LDL, the bad stuff. They catch it and try and get rid of it. So then in that process, they wheel things off, and it's called a foam cell. So if you like to have fun, go to the morgue, ask to look at somebody's coronary artery or someone's peripheral arteries and look for foam cells. Obviously, they won't let you do that. I'm just joking. But then in those foam cells, there's an oxidative stress, which means things aren't as perking and popping as they should be. And all of a sudden, you have a significant amount of inflammation in your blood vessel walls. Now, a lot of times we pick that up by a test called a highly sensitive CRP. So the highly sensitive CRP, cheap way of saying it, if it's high, oxidative stress, not good, because when you have an area that's got an area of trying to re-help itself out, clean out the bad stuff, it does predispose to a heart attack. All of a sudden, then you're going to get another character, vascular smooth muscle starts to proliferate to try and form a plaque, which means it's going to try and cover it over, hide it, stuff it in a bag. Then all of a sudden, you've noticed that your vessel wall is getting smaller. Now remember, in the Indian population, they tend to have smaller vessels than, say, most Americans. So those people have to be very careful. See somebody in that business who knows what it's like to take care of those kind of patients, and they'll be much, much more better served by those kind of cardiologists, which are around, and they're fantastic, and they save a lot of deaths. So what's happening is you have this plaque that's coming in there. You've got cholesterol stuck in it. The body's trying to put a bag in it in the wall. Your arterial demeter, because it's getting fat, all of a sudden there's blood flow restriction. So there's more trauma there. And all of a sudden they call that an ischemic or thrombotic consequence. So ischemia means that the blood vessel's not getting in because there's too much plaque. Things tend to plaque over, and it gets to be less of an issue of getting blood flow where it should be. And things get initially dysfunctional endothelium. In other words, the vessel walls are alive and they do things. So all of a sudden you have dysfunction predisposes to that heart attack. And also the lipid molecules that are in there are starting to oxidize or get sugar-coated. And all of a sudden you have a dysfunctional arterial system and you don't want your heart to be dysfunctional. Now what we do is we treat with statins, number one. The big two are atorvastatin and Crestor. That's Lipitor and Crestor. They have the two major studies published that show a massive improvement in well-being when you get these medications, if you have that. Now, additionally, if we don't get what we want, we can add in Zetia, which blocks intestinal absorption of cholesterol. When this happens, it's not getting fed into the cell linings, so your arterioles are doing better. So they use statins first, Zetia next. Of course, you have to go by your doctor. And then they'll use PCSK9-type medications, which are monoclonals, which beat the devil out of these plaques, thank God. And then there's a medication just on the market, inclisiran, that also does the same thing. So we have a number of medications that are helping people not get heart attacks, to reverse plaquing in their heart. So that is a fantastic benefit. So we do want to point out that clinical presentation, usually these patients, is going to be somebody who's overweight, obese, somebody who's got type 2 diabetes mellitus, somebody who's drinking a little bit too much alcohol. 55% of the patients who suffer from this have elevated triglycerides and a low HDL, and they're not receiving any lipid management. So I love talking to people about this, mainly because I know if I can get them to spend 15 cents a day, they're going to live longer and better. So again, that's going to be it for the lipid stuff. We want to make sure everybody lives longer. And now we're going to talk about something a little bit fun. And that's going to be the GLP-1 drugs. So if there's one area that a doctor can get attacked on is, how come I can't get my GLP-1 drug? Is it because of the insurance company? Is it because of the cost? And is it because they're not diabetic, or is it because they're not obese? So generally, if you have decent insurance and your body weight index is over 30, you're a candidate to get these GLP-1 drugs that result in significant weight loss at 12 to 18%. And our previous pharmacology never could do that. We were generally getting 5% when we used certain drugs such as phentermine and topiramate with bupropion. So we couldn't get that 18%. Now, I will tell you this, there's a lot of people who are way over 18%. I will tell you this, that 93 million meet the GLP-1 weight loss eligibility criteria. The price is generally $12,000 to $16,000 a year, even with maximum negotiated discounts. So say you're going to pay $6,500. Most of us can't afford that. But again, these drugs have turned into magic. They result in a significant weight loss. They basically decrease stroke, decrease MI. See what Medicare recently said. You can use a GLP-1 to help out your cardiovascular status. What's going to happen with that? That just came down a week ago or 2 weeks ago. So the question is, it's going to cost about $237,000 to $480,000 quality-adjusted life year. So from a economic perspective, GLP-1s are not really what any insurance company or any mathematician would like to get. So 27% of patients prescribed GLP-1 agonists were adherent after 1 year. So the problem is that a lot of people just don't like to be told that they're not going to eat. And when you take those medications, you lose your appetite. Your weight can drop off. We know Oprah Winfrey is one of those who just did it, and she just did one of those metamorphoses again. So the problem is high price, low cost effectiveness in the older drugs, poor long-term adherence, and payer interruption has resulted in significant problems. But I will tell you this, that the overall benefit is significant. Again, it has been proven to reduce cardiovascular events. It reduces your obesity. It lowers your pressure. Makes people feel better, look better. They get up and do more because they're just enthralled by how fast that they don't eat anymore and that their weight peels off. Any good thing. So I can say this, that rationing GLP agonists reduce costs, It withholds many patients from substantial short-term weight loss achieving these agents. Yes, if you meet that criteria and your insurance company doesn't feel that you do, you also have the weight loss surgeons who do a great job, and generally you lose 30% of your body weight with that. They're incredibly competent and excellent in the Philadelphia, New Jersey marketplace. So GLP-1s are fantastic. They cost money. It's hard to pay for it if you don't have insurance. There's four basic ones on the market now for weight loss. Remember, they changed the names. So there's two names for diabetic drugs, and there's two names for obesity drugs. So you just have to get the vocabulary together. But these GLP-1 agonists make sure your health is better. They are tremendous ability to fight weight, and people love also how they look. So again, what's going to happen with these GLP-1s is going to become more in vogue. We have two major companies making these drugs. We know once was stated that Novo Nordisk's GDP is greater than the whole country of Denmark. So you can see it's used incredibly well. People love it. And I can say this, that they're an incredible advantage. And with the new Medicare assessment, that you can use it for decreasing heart issues is a step in the right direction. Now, what else are we going to do on Easter time? I got to see what else I wanted to talk about. All right. Okay. All right. Let's see here. All right. Well, I do want to make a quote, and this is from Bill Belichick. He's still around, but not actively coaching football teams. On perseverance, it's not all about talent. It's about dependability, consistency, and being able to improve. So is that an important statement to ingrain on our young kids? It's not about talent. It's about dependability, consistency, and being able to improve. And that's Bill Belichick, retired football coach from New England, a big-time winner for sure. Now, just want to go over those lipid goals. So remember, you want your LDL cholesterol to be 74 or less. If you achieve that, you get that 45% reduction in MI, stroke, and death, which is fantastic. So let's make sure that you talk to your family doctor or your cardiologist about, am I hitting the right goals? Am I going to prevent myself from getting a cardiovascular event? Very, very important. Now, we do want to say that just going over some of the issues that can occur, early signs of Alzheimer's and dementia. A key to effective treatment of Alzheimer's is detecting disease as early as possible. Ultimately, researchers hope new tests will enable routine diagnosis before symptoms, which typically occur years after the disease develops. The Alzheimer's Association cites some early dementia symptoms. Alzheimer's disease associates cite memory loss that disrupts daily life. Forgetting recently learned information, important dates or events, asking the same question over and over, increasingly needing to rely on memory aids or family members for things you used to handle on your own. But occasionally forgetting names or appointments, but remember them later, isn't necessarily a cause of concern. Number two, challenges in planning or solving problems. Changes in your ability to develop and follow a plan or work with numbers. You may have trouble following a familiar recipe or keeping track of bills. You may have trouble concentrating and taking longer on to-do things. You may have trouble, on the other hand, it's normal to make occasional errors managing finances and household bills. Difficulty completing familiar tasks. You may have trouble driving to a familiar location, organizing a grocery list, or remembering the rules of your favorite game. It's not particularly concerning if you occasionally need help using microwave settings or recording a TV show. Confusion with time or place. You lose track of dates, seasons, and passage of time. You may have trouble understanding something, if it's not happening immediately. Sometimes you may forget where you are or how you got there. But don't worry, it's not unusual to be confused about the day of the week, but figure it out later. Trouble understanding visual images and spatial relationships. You could experience vision changes that lead to difficulty with balance or reading, or have problems judging distances and determining color or contrast, causing issues with driving. This is different from visual changes related to cataracts. So, this is Dr. Fallon, Easter Sunday. Make sure everybody has a great time. Take a look upstairs. We'll be back next week. Inside Medicine, Dr. Joseph J. Fallon, Jr., MD, signing off. Great Easter, everybody. Thank you much.